Jack Waterford was living in a shared household in Canberra back in the early 70s with a group of activists. Then the phone bill came in and no one could afford it, so Jack went out to get a job. He walked down the road and knocked on the door of the Canberra Times, and Jack was given a job as a copy boy. One of the editors at the time didn't really much care for Jack and predicted he wouldn't last long at that paper. But Jack became a cadet, then a journalist, then deputy editor, editor, and eventually editor-in-chief. And over 40 years later, Jack is still the editor-at-large at the Canberra Times. Throughout his long career, Jack Waterford has vigorously pursued the cause of freedom of information because, as one publisher once put it, news is what somebody somewhere wants to suppress. All the rest is advertising. Hello, Jack Waterford.
How are you?
I'm well, sir. What do most people get wrong about Canberra?
I think it's the notion that we're in some sort of airy-fairy land, isolated from the rest of the world, when in fact we're the most connected capital, the most connected city in Australia. It's horrible to say to Sydney-siders or to Melbourne-siders that they're a very parochial place. But you could live in Sydney for a year and not hear Melbourne mentioned. Likewise in Brisbane. Whereas Canberra, because its business is government and its business is information, is full of people who are actually quite interested in what's happening on the other side of the world, on the other side of the nation, all around our region. And not just that, but they come from there, so they speak about it with, you know, good and fresh information. Whereas 9 times out of 10, if I'm talking to a Sydney-sider and hearing Canberra slagged off, it's with some anecdote that's in fact 20 or 30 years old.
I've lived in Canberra for 4 years or so, and one of the things, it is kind of irritating after a while, the Canberra bashing that goes on outside of Canberra. And it's often, it's like hearing a friend badmouthed in such a way that, you know, that friend's not like that at all. It's very odd, isn't it? So then, and then when Canberra people sort of arc up a bit, they go, oh, well, touchy are we? Aren't we getting touchy?
Yeah, there's a bit of that. Mind you, there's an attractive part about it. I think the fact that Australians are by and large cynical about politicians and to some extent about public servants is a good thing. We're not that, you know, obedient to people. In that sort of sense, the Canberra equals government sort of equation is understandable enough. And sometimes when you test it out a bit, the people of Australia are by and large very proud of Canberra. They don't seem to be very proud of its people. They don't seem to be very proud of the current politicians we've got, whoever they happen to be at any particular time. But they actually see this as a beautiful designed city with great solid buildings. They recognise instantly about 20 or 30 buildings in it. And if you think of Sydney, say, well, people recognise Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Opera House and whatnot, but you're starting to stretch it after that. Brisbane, not so many places as well, but Canberra, the War Memorial, the old Parliament House, the new Parliament House, the Parliament thing is etched on the Australian consciousness. And deep down, most Australians are pretty proud of that.
If you do have criticisms to make of Canberra as a city, what would they be likely to be, Jay?
Oh, I think to some extent we settle a little bit for the second rate. This should be a city of great architecture, and there is some great architecture here, but I'm afraid none of it is less than 50 years old. The last great building built in Canberra was probably the National Library, and I don't even like that very much. But the old School of Art, the Ainslie Primary School, the Manuka Baths, some of the Art Deco buildings around it are absolutely glorious. And so in their sort of Kremlin-esque way are some of the first great administration buildings. The modern Parliament House, of course, is fantastic. I like that, and I like it because it is so Canberra in the sense that it doesn't sort of force itself at you, but it nestles down into the hill.
Paul Keating once used to muse about the idea that wouldn't it be great, he thought, to actually get the executive government out, by that, you know, the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, the Ministers, out of Parliament House, get their offices out there and put them elsewhere in the capital. What do you think of that idea?
I think it is long past due. The dominance of the executive over Parliament is the primary reason why Parliament and parliamentarians are in such low order in Australia today. The geography of the Parliament House is determined by the needs of the executive government. The barriers to communication that are there, which include the fact that there's something like 20 miles of corridors, all a sort of result of the great power of the executive over.
So the executive kind of sits on the parliament then.
They sit on it.
Yes. Do they a bit?
Yes.
And there's Dorothy Dixer questions, and it's all so much of parliament's thing is about
organised around their timetable,
right?
And increasingly, although this has always been a feature of Australian government, but increasingly organised around the caucuses and the idea that the governing party speaks with one voice and that there is no room, if you like, for independence or a particular thing. Although you're allowed, of course, to be a spelling crank, as King O'Malley was or Doug Everingham was, but only harmless eccentricities are tolerated.
How about getting the press gallery out of...
Oh, I'd
love
to see that too.
I think it
would be very good for the press gallery, for starters, and it would be very good for politics. I have nothing against the intense coverage of politics and public administration, but I think you need to be detached a little bit from it. And I think that in Canberra, which is such a wonderful resource of knowledge everywhere, it is so seductive working in this walled city of Parliament House to think that all knowledge resides there within it. So there's a tendency for journalists, if they're covering transport, say, to think that I'll go to the Minister for Transport's office and get his opinion on something, and then I'll go to the Shadow Ministers and get his opinion on that, and possibly go to the Greens to get their opinion on that, and that will represent the sum of all knowledge. Meanwhile, out there, there's academia, there's think tanks, there's lobbies.
There's traffic jams.
And there's the Parliament House that actually contains an incredible body of enduring knowledge about transport issues, which is all too often not consulted.
You're a Canberra institution now, but you didn't grow up in Canberra. What part of Australia did you grow up in, Jack?
I grew up in northwestern New South Wales. I was on a sheep station, originally around Quambone near Canamble. When I was about 10 or 11, we moved out to Gadooga, which is up on the Queensland border, northeast of Bourke. I went away to boarding school at the age of about 10. There were no schools reasonably close. But luckily, I was actually fairly well-read and educated at that point, in major part because of the good fortune of having broken my leg at the age of 5 and being so bored witless that I learnt to read.
Ongoing theme on this program is people who do interesting things have had some period of long convalescence for some reason or another in their childhood. This is very interesting.
But it was also, but it was also accentuated by the complete absence of television from our lives, and the fact that my family and my wider clan were deeply into, say, poetry, you know, of the Banjo Paterson type and whatnot, but we learnt poems off by heart. We had sort of quite a lively sort of conversation about that.
The nation of station life in those days was so many people were real autodidacts, weren't they? Very, very well-read people, because there was no television at night, so the books you had were precious.
Yes.
And was your family station people? Were they have long-standing connections to the land?
Yes. My mother was an O'Brien of the Warren district, and she had 9 sisters and a brother, all of whom ultimately sort of devolved onto the land, apart from the odd one who became a nun, at least for a while. My father's side were often on the land and were, you know, sort of Irish and English convict stock. So we'd had long sort of associations with the land, and I had lived in an area of what you might sort of say where there were kin almost everywhere.
And were you working on the land yourself? Did you actually do some of the work there?
Oh, yeah.
And what kind of work was it?
Oh, well, like by the time I was 15 or 16, I could kill a sheep, I could shear a sheep, I could ride a horse, muster, all of those sorts of things. And I did so right through my school days, in part to earn money, but also because I, you know, really enjoyed that sort of life on the land.
Tell me about the pleasure in that kind of work, the pleasure you get at the end of the day from it.
Well, it was hard work, but it was not actually, if you like, physically exhausting most of the time, although you could be jolly, jolly sore after a full day in the saddle. But it, you know, there was a close relationship between what you did and sort of what you achieved. I've often thought that that's one of the satisfying things too about journalism, that it would be wonderful to be a poet or an author writing whatnot, but there's, to some extent, there's a big gap between the actual book that you hold in your hands and the sum of today's production, whereas every morning you can sort of look up and you know, see with some pleasure something that you did.
How big was your immediate family on that station?
I had there were eight children in my family. My oldest sister Claire, she died when I was six. Sorry, when I was four, when she was six. So we grew up largely as a family of seven.
How did she die?
She drowned in a country dam on Boxing Day in 1956.
What happened that day?
Oh, well, it was just one of those sort of things. The clan all gathered, children playing at the pool, adults preparing lunch, possibly a slip of supervision. There's no finger of blame to point about it, but one of the sort of consequences of it is that, you know, I've always loved being surrounded by children and so forth like that. But I have this tendency to mentally count them about once every minute.
Yeah, did you remember that day? I mean, you were only four, but do you have any...
Yes, I do have memories of that day. I was there when Claire was fished out of the water. I remember actually thinking to myself that, you know, that she's dead, but that nobody would ever acknowledge that I would know what such a thing was, whereas as a country boy, I was well used to the cycle of life and death on the property. You know, we killed a sheep every week and things like that. So I understood the finality part of it all. But there were parts of it which, look back with now, we might have handled better, I think. I mean, I think there was a tendency not to talk about it. Both my father and my mother were obviously very deeply affected, but it was not the sort of an item of conversation in the family until too much longer, I think.
Back in that day, it was, you know, least said, soonest mended and all
yes.
that. Your dad had an interesting life, hadn't he, too, certainly during the war?
Yes. Dad went into the war, joined the 8th Division, ended up being captured in Singapore, was on the Burma Railway. He had a vaguely rural background, but it was one that was truncated by the Depression. And so he was, if you like, a quite bright, interested and alert person, but without much in the way of a formal education.
Did he talk much about the Burma Railway? Did he talk?
Not when we were kids. Later on, in the 60s, he became ill and we left the property and the family moved to Glebe in Sydney. And then later on, through his illness, my father wrote frequently both of the clan, the family generally, his own reminiscences of it, but particularly a quite good book, which has since, I might say, been translated into Japanese, but about the experience of being a prisoner of war. And it's interesting particularly for the fact that it has almost no hostility to the Japanese and a lot of sort of love and forgiveness in it. He remembers songs they sang and, you know, there's some quite good oral history stuff in it, but not a lot of that sort of bitterness and, you know, unconstrained anger against the guards and whatnot that so motivated many of the people who wrote reminiscences of it.
So you moved from country New South Wales to hippie Glebe in inner city Sydney. And this is what, the 1960s, early 60s?
Yes, mid-1960s. And it was a very interesting time because Glebe was shifting somewhat from being a sort of a working class inner city suburb to being a somewhat trendy university.
Student dormitory.
There were lots of very interesting people around. Jermaine Greer was just down the road. So were an array of push people. Our house, which in rural times had always been an open door but sort of freely visited by clan and family, remained such because we were now, in effect, the Sydney headquarters of the clan, but there were also now interesting neighbours and people who were sort of wandering through. My parents, who were always very interested in the wider world, I think saw this as, you know, in considerable ways a liberation, you know.
And how about your mum in particular? How did living in Sydney change things for your mum, Jack?
Well, she, for one, had at one stage graduated very well out of high school, matriculated, and had been going to do medicine at Sydney, but she was told that she couldn't because the war, which was on, was about to end, and that soon there'd be more men returning from the war and under repat schemes, etc., doing medicine, and there'd be more doctors than you could poke a stick at. And after all, as we know, while we're not against women being doctors, it's a bit of a waste of public money to have them being doctors, because they only get married, you know, and sort of disappear out of the workforce.
Right, so time to give up your hobby girly and go home?
Go home, yes. And that probably suited my grandfather in a way. He was a wonderful guy, but who tended to regard the city and large conurbations as the source of all evil, and, you know, the country air and village or station life is about the epitome of Christian virtue, etc.
So what did your mum do after leaving uni then?
Well, she decided that, first of all, that she might become a nun.
Wow.
So she went off to New Zealand, went into a novitiate. She tried it out. Her sister was already there. She gave it a few years, decided against it, and came back, and in due course did the other great Catholic girl thing, which was marry and have 8 children.
So there they are in Glebe with this. Both of them had this really interesting background, your folks. Did their politics evolve now in the 60s in living in Glebe?
Yes, the politics essentially swung sharply to the left, I suppose, but they were also, if you like, a reflection of a changing family, of the fact that they themselves were always interested in politics, and of the fact that there was always a small L liberal
Social justice-oriented
Catholicism that was involved in it. My father had always been involved, for example, in promoting the notion of Aboriginal rights.
How had he done that?
Oh, by pushing for housing in country towns in New South Wales, particularly around Coonamble, by trying to create pressure that would force the better development of resources there. He himself had learned from his grandfather, who was a local solicitor and was probably always the softest touch in the district. And some of it was not, if you like, necessarily pro-Aboriginal focused, as underdog focused, I suppose. But there was a strong tradition of that in the family. There was also, I suppose, a strong tradition of service and tendency to think that one had some obligation to a wider world if one had been brought up well and fortunately and well educated, etc.
Were they religious people as such?
Well, religion was a very strong part of the clan's life. We were Irish Catholic people. We grew up in an area that was sort of strongly family oriented, but where politics began and where religion ended was sort of never entirely clear. But the idea that one owed one's country, one's fellow citizens, one's community, one's family sort of something, and that the sheer pursuit of self-interest or something like that was something mildly contemptible, ran fairly strongly in the family. If you look at all my brothers and sisters, say, for example, it's amazing how many of them, have essentially devoted their lives to working with other people for what you might call public goods.
So you went to boarding school for a while, and how did you like that?
I loved it.
You loved boarding school?
Yes.
You might be the very first person who's ever been on this program to say, I love boarding school.
Look, I was, in certain respects, a hard case there, and while I don't complain of abuse or anything like that, I was one of the people most likely to be getting 6 of the best every morning and every night, and was regarded as sort of cheeky and disobedient and various things like that. But it was a wonderful environment nonetheless, and for all of its ferocious reputation, it was an academically free environment. You might get flogged to within an inch of your life if you were out of bounds, but in the classroom you could contradict your teacher or dispute it or whatnot without any problems at all. I had some wonderful teachers, absolutely outstanding ones, who've remained good friends with me all my life. I still regularly talk to them, and these days, of course, I'm occasionally burying them. There was one stage, actually, just thinking of it, where a teacher said to me in exasperation, a very old teacher, incidentally, but he said, Jack Waterford, you are the most infuriating student I've had since I taught your great-uncle Leo in 1900. And my great uncle Leo was still alive, and I consulted him, and he remembered well baiting this particular teacher.
It sounds like that made a real mark on you. And I suppose you can learn all kinds of things from that. Then, where you know the rules are strict, but nonetheless, there's the freedom to disagree without fear of punishment for honest intellectual disagreement.
Yes.
And that's something that's affected the way you choose to disagree, I wonder?
Well, possibly sometimes. I mean, there were things I disagreed with them about that were starting to matter.
I wouldn't
characterise everything in straight political terms or whatnot, but...
Because you like to disagree, but...
Yeah.
You did, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are unfailingly polite when you do disagree. Is that a fair way of putting it, Jack?
Normally, yes. Yeah.
Normally?
I certainly was at school.
Yes.
I certainly was at school. But the zones of disagreement were changing. I mean, I don't think this is particularly a result of my Catholic or Irish upbringing or anything like that, but I was of a generation that was at the head of the baby boomers, if you like, and by the 60s, one of the reasons for the 60s was that a generation was emerging, and it was a bigger lump than usually, that were asking, in effect, is that all there is? They were wondering about, you know, social justice in the wider community, about whether a nation that was prospering fairly well could reach out a little bit more, either internationally or to our Aboriginal population or to some of people's single mothers and so forth. So there was a critique developing of what we would have called a smug and complacent society. We were being taught in school, almost as an article of faith, that thanks to J.M. Keynes, we had more or less sort of cracked economies, and that there would never be a depression, possibly never even a recession again. So we were looking, and we certainly lived through a period, if you like, of modest but unfailing growth,
and a big
development of
resources too,
and so forth like that. And there were people sort of saying, well, you know, shouldn't we be sharing the wealth around a little bit more? So as this was developing, this critique came to involve questions like Aboriginal rights, issues like racism, and very close to home, because it did affect us very personally, but issues such as conscription and the Vietnam War that Australia had been plunged into.
So you were certainly would have been a candidate for conscription in Vietnam.
Yes.
I was, in fact,
called up, or I would have been had I enrolled, which I didn't. But I had been thrown out of school cadets for being bad for morale. I was the only person in my platoon who could march in step.
So how did you then... You objected to the Vietnam War, Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War, and you objected to being conscripted. How did you actually avoid being...
Well, I was one of a number of quite open draft dodgers. We not only didn't register for national service, but we proclaimed to everybody that we hadn't registered. We made a bit of a habit of going around to politicians' places and surrendering ourselves to be taken off to jail and so forth. The government, while not wanting to be seen to be weakening on the subject, had learnt that most of our stunts backfired on them, and so they were not particularly keen to have too many draft dodgers in jail at any one time. But right through 1972, for example, in strict theory, this was while I was working at the Canberra Times, I might say, in strict theory there was a warrant out for my arrest for failing to register.
So were you ever arrested for that?
Not for that. I was arrested for many other things over sort of demonstration-style offences over a period of time. But no, the local police weren't in the least bit interested in pursuing Commonwealth offences, and the Commonwealth police were not particularly competent.
No one wanted the spectacle of dragging you out of a house?
No. No, these things did happen from time to time, but we had to work really hard, actually, on this self-image of ourselves as sort of fleeing from safe house to safe house, and, you know...
Well, it wasn't actually quite like that then.
Most of the time it was tediously boring. There were very exciting moments. You know, Michael Matheson's escapades sort of running through an ABC studio was sort of absolutely fabulous theatre, but it was a perfect example of why, at the end of the day, The government didn't want that many episodes of it.
There was a famous incident where you appeared at the Attorney General Tom Hughes's house there, and he grabbed his son's cricket bat and went after you. You and another interesting bloke too.
Yes, there was another lad with me. I don't know what happened to him. He was a sort of left-wing activist of the time called Ian MacDonald. Last I heard of him, he'd gone into New South Wales politics or something.
I wonder how
he got
on.
Whacked. He got whacked. A month or two after that, Tom Hughes came out to the ANU and he and I had another confrontation. This time we were wrestling over a Viet Cong flag.
Did you ever speak to him in years gone by about
that? Well, it was a couple of years later I first saw him because I was working at the Canberra Times and he was acting for us in a libel writ, and he looked at me and said something like, "You bastard," or something, but not a great deal of time after that, I was chatting to him about it and made some sort of remark.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
Today I'm with Jack Waterford, editor-at-large of the Canberra Times. Jack, we were talking about how you'd arrived as an anti-Vietnam conscription protester with your then colleague, Ian MacDonald, at the house of Tom Hughes, who was the federal government's attorney general, and he went after you with a cricket bat. Did that lead to a reconciliation many years later?
Yes. Tom tired of politics, and he defrosted quite considerably. His nickname was Frosty, but he became much more liberal-minded about things. But on one occasion, when he and I were having a fairly frank and full disagreement about something, I said to him politely that I hoped that the venom of our exchange hadn't been aggravated by our previous engagement. And he said, "Oh, no, 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 no." He says, "As for all of that, you were right, I was wrong." And I thought that was inordinately generous of him. Tom now thinks that the Vietnam War was a massive, foolish mistake.
Do you think our media need to be more accommodating of those kinds of statements from elected leaders? "I made a mistake. I don't think I quite got that right."
Oh, yes. And I think we see signs all of the time that this works quite well. The classic example, of course, is with Gareth Evans, who pleaded the streaker's excuse. You know, it seemed like a good excuse at the time. This was after he'd put the F-111s over Tasmania or something. But everybody had a great laugh and then promptly forgave him. Okay, they did affectionately call him Biggles ever after, but you know,
that's good for someone like Gareth Evans to be called Biggles, I think.
Yes. But the next good example was Peter Beattie. Peter Beattie was very good at saying, "Look, I really buggered that up, and now I've really got to fix it up, and I'm the bloke to fix it up because I knew how to bugger it up," and or whatever. But he would say it in a sort of self-deprecating way that, by and large, people would swallow. This sort of idea that a politician's mind must be immutable, or that everybody thinks exactly the same way. It's, of course, aggravated by things like mobile telephones, so that, you know, if Wayne Swan says something in Perth and Julia Gillard says something slightly different in Brisbane, you know, they'll be both parsed and analysed and they'll be accused of being disloyal to each other or something like that.
That's just ridiculous, isn't it?
It's just shades of the same thing.
This aha moment that takes place.
That's a good example of what I would say is the reasons why journalists ought to get away from the gallery and stand back a little bit, because the public, there is a small public that is intensely interested in politics, but the wider public does not particularly like all the close-in infighting and this sort of parsing and analysis, and would enjoy their politics more and would respect their politicians more if you were genuinely allowed to think aloud. If you're allowed to sort of say, "Well, I wouldn't put it that way," and actually politely contradict your leader or whatever, because it's actually the way politics is carried out in most parts of the world, including the United States.
I just wanted to ask you one more question about your student activist days. Tell me about the time you were arrested at the South African Embassy, Jack Waterford.
Well, I was arrested in 1971 at the South African Embassy in the lead-up to the Springbok rugby tour. The thing that I think you're coming to is that many, many years later, on the eve of South Africa becoming a genuine non-racial democracy, the South African foreign minister, Pik Botha, who somewhat reluctantly had played a major role in being the handmaiden of this transition, but was in Australia and was at the South African embassy, and I was invited to go over there to a dinner with him, actually with Gareth, amongst others. But at one stage, I leaned over to Pik and said, "You know, Mr. Botha, the last time I was here, I was being chased across the ground by a policeman." And he said, "Yes, I knew." He didn't sound that happy about it either.
He knew exactly who he was dining with then, did he?
Yes.
So there you are living in Canberra in the 70s, and you're in, I don't know, I think I got that story right at the start. You're in a group house there with a group of activists.
Yes.
What was that phone bill like that forced you to get a job anyway?
It was $1,800, which was for 6 months. Now, that's a very substantial sum even today, but in those days it was probably worth the equivalent of, say, $6,000 or $7,000 today. So we were, you know, in desperate straits for a little while about how we could pay it, and we morally had to pay it. In normal circumstances, the idea of owing some money to the Commonwealth of Australia wouldn't have put us in a deep panic. But the phone was in the name of somebody who had already left the house, and to leave him stuck with it would have been unsporting and unfair.
Ah, I see. So that meant you had to get the job, and knocked on the door of the Canberra Times. What kind of a welcome did you get into the newsroom?
Well, I was initially sort of said, "Oh, yes, you can start tomorrow." In those days, although this was no part of my thinking, there was no journalism degrees as such at university, and people became journalists by working around a newsroom until they got a cadetship of 3 or 4 years, and many of those people who became cadets had been copy boys, which is what the job that I took on was.
How different were newsrooms back then?
Oh, well, for starters, they were a lot noisier than today. There was not just the clatter of typewriters, old Royals and Imperials banging, but there was telexes over in the corner, and there was a lot of smoking. It was like Mad Men for smoking.
Right, there was a big, thick fug of cigarette smoke in the office.
And in the case of the Canberra Times, as some readers would remember, the fug of the Filipino cheroots, which were sort of like dried dog turds that Bruce Juddery's smoked, that sort of caramelised everything within range. And a lot of shouting and swearing going on. Anyway, it was good fun. But the editor came over to me and he said, "That fool of a chief of staff didn't know who you were, but I know who you are. And let me tell you, there is no way whatever that you're ever going to get a job as a journalist here."
How did he know who you were anyway?
Well, because I was one of these long-haired communist ratbag people who was perpetually in his court pages, usually for things like failure to move on or offensive behaviour or resist arrest or something.
Hesitating
like that.
With intent to loiter?
Yes, that sort of thing.
So there you are at the Canberra Times as this cadet, a copy boy that becomes a cadet and then a journalist. You were in journalism around about the same time as the Whitlam government got into power. That must have been an extraordinary time for a journalist with all that reform happening.
It was just a fabulous time. It was a fabulous time also, not just to be in Parliament, but to some extent to be in Canberra at the time. Some of the best stories I got, say, for example, were in the old Canberra Times office rather than in the press gallery. There was a chap who worked beside me, say, for example, who was a very right-wing journalist, a very good journalist, but of pronouncedly, well, nothing, and regarded by some people as, in effect, the ASIO man in the Canberra Times. And for some reason, he and I got on fabulously well and were called by Bruce Juddery the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. But I came into the office one day and his phone rang. I picked up the phone and said, "Hello." And the person said, "Frank, I haven't got much time to talk, but Murphy's on his way down to Canberra, down to Melbourne at the moment to raid ASIO."
This is the Attorney General, Lionel Murphy.
Night he raided ASIO here in Canberra. "But I haven't got time to talk. I'll ring you back later." Hung up. Frank came in about 5 minutes later and I told him. This was one of the first times I saw a real sort of professional operation. We talked about it and Frank said something like, "You know, if Murphy is doing that, we won't be able to hold on to it. I think we'll tip off the Melbourne Herald." But we only gave the Melbourne Herald about a half of the story. which did not include the earlier raid on Camberasia. Anyway, when Lionel Murphy arrived in his Commonwealth cars at St Kilda Road, wherever Asia was in those days, there were already snappers from the Melbourne Herald there, and Lionel, for the first time, got his thought, what have I done here? Because it was on the front pages of all of the papers in Australia the next day. Anyway, that was just, if you like, an accident of happening to be there, but there was a vast sense of excitement in the air. The Whitlam government was not just doing things at a fabulous rate, but they were conceiving great ideas, they were articulating great visions, they were seeking to move the national mind and the national, what's the word for it, energy into things. So
All at once.
Yes, and it was impossible, and it was hopeless, and it was incompetent, and it was all of that. But just the, you know, the sheer energy going into it was quite exhilarating.
You were there, of course, on the dismissal day of November the 11th, 1975. Were you there at Parliament House?
Yes, I was there at Parliament House. I was not there at the moment of the dismissal.
No.
But I heard the Speaker call, the Prime Minister, and I heard Malcolm Fraser get up, and I knew immediately, and at the speed of light, I was over at Parliament House, and I was on the steps of Parliament House when I heard the Parliament dissolve and heard Whitlam's curse speech.
I was just a kid when that happened. I have memories of it, and I've seen the footage of it, of course, and the crowd is really quite lively, to say the very least. And I think later on, Gough Whitlam himself congratulated himself on his own restraint, because he wrote, it was actually a lovely evening and perfect for a walk with the crowd round to Yarralumla, where the Governor-General lives. Could you feel a sense of revolt in the air that day, or was not that serious?
It was very definitely there, and indeed by evening's end there were a few more temperate than most people, such as Bob Hawke, who were actually worrying aloud that a rebellion, you know, some sort of armed revolt or civil war might be being stirred up, and, you know, talked to people about, you know, maintain your rage, but if you like, restrain your anger, because, you know, it was very sort of tense at times.
After that, you spent some time with Fred Hollows. Tell me how you came across Fred Hollows and his work.
I first met Fred through Gordon Briscoe, an Aboriginal person here in Canberra, who sort of encouraged me not just to meet Fred, but also to help draft a submission that was going to set up the National Trachoma Program to deal with extraordinary rates of blindness and whatnot from a trachoma, which is a conjunctivitis style of disease that is essentially always abolished by dragging people out of poverty. I met Fred and was immediately incredibly taken by him. Fred was an incredibly complex, tempestuous person. He could be quite unfair and rude and violent in his language, sexist and all of that sort of thing. But he was also an incredibly inspirational person. To be around him was to live in a sort of a constant university of ideas. He was always, if you like, a person challenging you about, well, what are you doing about it? What are you going to do about it? And asking your advice, what should I do about it and whatnot. So, you know, he changed people, he changed situations, he certainly changed me.
And what were you doing with his organisation?
I was doing, my main job was, if you like, liaising with the Commonwealth and with state agencies between Fred and the sort of the teams on the ground. But long term, I was writing and drawing up the report, the epidemiological findings we had. In travelling around on the ground, I was part of a team that was all mucking in, but my main job was actually scribing to Fred, which was, if you like, taking all of his medical notes for him, and so engaged pretty well all day long in a continuous conversation with him.
What was that like as a personal experience? Was it joyous or frustrating or horrible?
Fred once commented late in his life, when people were sort of praising him and giving him awards and things like that, you know, that they spoke as if he lived this life of noble self-sacrifice. And in only one sense was this true, that Fred could have devoted himself to the sort of wallets of very rich old ladies and the sort of people who in their old age have a lot of eye diseases. But what Fred had decided to do instead was to work amongst admittedly poorer people or something like that, but much more interesting conditions, much more interesting people to work with and to talk to and to gather around him, people who were actually capable of making a difference to the eye pathology he was seeing. If you're 80 years old and your eyes aren't too good, basically they're buggered. There's not very much that can be done to improve it. But if you see a 12-year-old child or a 12-month-old child suffering from a condition that you know you can address, you can actually make that person see. Fred was much more engaged by that sort of process. He thought it was more fun. He thought he had a life much richer and better lived than some of these people who supposedly, you know, did not make the sacrifice or something like that. So it was actually, you know, most of the time working with Fred was like, you know, being a sort of a merry prankster in a gang, travelling around, making mayhem and doing somewhat naughty things, certainly poking our finger in the eye of the establishment, and we loved it. Of course, we fought incessantly amongst ourselves. We often worked 6 weeks solid every day, and then we would sort of have a blowout, you know, for 2 or 3 days and then hit the road again or something. But even as we were, you know, about to tear each other's eye out, if we were down at the pub and anybody attacked us, well, it was like the sort of the Hell's Angels, you know, touch us, touch
all of us, right.
Touch all of us, all of that. So that was exhilarating too.
Yeah, one of the things I love about your journalism, in fact, is the long view you're able to take after, what, 4 decades or so in journalism. Yeah. A few months ago, you received a report under freedom of information laws that you requested 29 years ago.
Yep.
29 years ago. 1982, you requested.
Yep.
And report under FOI. That's got to be a record, surely, doesn't it?
Well, it's a record that nobody's ever going to beat. I must say, I didn't pursue it with all of the vigour that I should have.
Still.
I put it in a request, and it was for the report of the Meat Commission into the kangaroo meat substitution scandal.
Of 1981 or two or thereabouts, yes.
And it was a real, real scandal. The government, the department said to me, look, we're going to have prosecutions as a result of this, so you can't have it for now. We're deferring access. And at the time I said, right, well, that's okay. I asked again about 5 years later and they said, no, we're still looking at prosecutions. And I said, I don't believe it, but I accepted it. But at a moment when I was annoyed about 3 or 4 years ago, I revived it. Even then, it took about 3 years to get the documents because there had to be all of these consultations between the police and the prosecuting authorities and Commonwealth State and so forth.
Now, just to be clear, this was a scandal in the early 80s where it was found that some of our beef exports were actually, the beef was being substituted for kangaroo meat,
horse meat, donkey meat.
Nothing new about a horse meat scandal, is there? In that sense. And our American trading partners were up in arms and the government needed to quickly reassure the government of the Americans that we were going to do
Prompt action was being taken.
There'll be a proper full inquiry.
Yes.
And an inquiry was held.
Yes.
And some reports, recommendations were made. What was done with those? What were done with those recommendations?
Well, essentially, they were filed, put aside. Nothing happened at all. It's what happened. What typically happens with all of these flurries of action. Calling an inquiry is not only a way of deferring a problem. At the end of the day, it's usually a way of sweeping it under the carpet.
This reminds you also of the AWB scandal in some ways too. How are they similar, do you think?
Well, they're very similar in the sort of sense that after a loud flurry of action, the denouncement of obvious villains, etc., and the announcement by the government, you know, that the files are being referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions and the AFP and that the guilty will be, you know, brought before the courts and punished, which is what happened with the Weed for Oil scandal. You wait, and only about a year or two ago, the Australian Federal Police announced that they were dropping their whole inquiry. And even then, they announced it only because somebody had asked them. They privately decided not to go ahead with it.
Why do authorities drag their feet in these kinds of situations?
Well, it's very interesting when you think, Richard, say that it was Kevin Rudd, who played a major role in bringing out this wheat for oil
the AWB scandal, yes.
But as Prime Minister, he showed no anxiety whatever to have that agitated brought up again. He was very critical of the way that the inquiry had been circumscribed to avoid bringing in the ministers, but he didn't use his undoubted powers to widen the inquiry or anything
like
that.
Why not? Why do you think?
Or let sleeping dogs lie, you know, only might sort of cause some problem that you can't control. We've already extracted our political dividend from it.
What about the federal police? Do you think they've investigated such things zealously?
I think the police forces of Australia have become in recent years intensely political, not necessarily in a political partisan sense, although often I see signs of that as well, but in the sense of having a feel for whether the government really wants to get at the bottom of this or doesn't, and they don't try very hard.
Is there a failure of journalism here too? I mean, isn't there? They must feel confident that they can drag their feet on this, if that's indeed what they're doing, because journalists have decided boring,
yeah,
no follow-up.
I think that's a part of the problem. But sometimes journalists have, if you like, some mixed things about it. For example, there are some leaks that the federal government does an awful lot about. There's a great flurry of activity, there's a lot of phone tapping, very lot of obvious action, and its effect is to send a wave of fear and loathing around the public service that if you leak, you'll get caught and action will be taken against you. So as a result, you know, there's been two Aboriginal people who have been prosecuted successfully in the last 10 years for leaking. The only people who've been prosecuted. But the wave of terror has had a very significant chilling effect all around the public service. But when there have been some obvious leaks, for example, there was one day when Alexander Downer's office called for a particular file which had been prepared by a discontented ONA officer who subsequently went into...
Office of National Assessments, yes. Intelligence officer, yes.
Yes, who subsequently went into politics. And the very next day, a fellow by the name of Andrew Bolt in Melbourne wrote a story saying this officer wasn't much chop anyway. His analysis was this, this and this, and quoted liberally from this paper which had been written. And the opposition called for a leak inquiry. And I remarked with... just by the way, that the policeman who couldn't solve this couldn't find his bum with both hands. the leak inquiry went on for 9 months, but no prosecution emerged, and it was unable to reach any conclusion as to where this document could possibly have come from. But on the other hand, although I made further sardonic references about it, I am not necessarily in the business of sicking police onto prosecuting politicians who leak, if you know what I mean.
What I'm hearing from you is a lot of kind of, don't make waves, don't embarrass the government of the day.
Yeah.
What do you think about this idea of Australia as a nation of larrikins who will speak truth to power all the time? How much truth do you think there really lies in that idea of who we are as a people? Are we really that, Jack, or are we more like the kind of, no point sticking my neck out, more like that?
There's an awful lot of obedient people in Australia. There's a lot of people who like to have this self-image of the larrikin. But there is, nonetheless, some streak of character in Australians, if you like, which enjoy seeing our politicians taken down a peg or two, or seeing them entirely discomforted. That's one of the reasons why it bemuses me that everybody wants to play with such a straight bat. The politician who is occasionally human is generally loved. Now, I personally didn't like Bob Hawke very much, either as a person or as a great statesman. But he's a very good example of somebody that the Australian people, if you like, you know, came to love, in part because of his very obvious and manifest imperfections. By contrast, an awful lot of very straight-laced and tight people have never been able to win their way into the public affection.
Just finally, you're editor-at-large. You have been editor-in-chief at the Canberra Times. I don't want to revisit all those, because we've had this ongoing discussion about the future of newspapers. But just let me ask you one question about those lines. Do you think our newspapers are going to have to die before they can be born again,
look,
in digital form?
I've wondered about that. I think that I think that they must be reinvented, and I wonder whether they will die before they are reinvented. I still think myself that there's a permanent place for print, because for all of the great advances of technology, and I embrace most of them except ones that involve use of my finger, you know, with alacrity, the there's something comforting about seeing something in print and its permanence and so forth. And it's actually very modern for all that the essential technology was 500 years old.
In Britain, it seems there's two models you can follow. One is the Daily Mail model, which is to go very digital and be really offer salacious tidbits, really.
Yes.
And that's very popular and quite successful.
Yes.
There's also the Guardian model, which is having some success, which is to shrink rapidly, become more focused on the issues you care about, and write longer, more long-form, more serious journalism about the issues you care about, and be run as a not-for-profit. I don't see any of our newspapers going in that direction,
That's what worries me. And Canberra is, this is one of the reasons that is so wonderful about Canberra. This is the place where we really ought to be trying it, I think. This is an area where people are intensely interested in news and is what is going on. It's not just instant news, or if it is, people are quite capable of getting that from myriad sources. But there are people in this town who get five or six newspapers a day. And they're not buying extra papers because the Canberra Times is inadequate. Far from it. They're buying it because they want to know what Michelle Grattan thinks, or what Paul Kelly thinks, or they want to see how it's playing in Sydney or how it's playing in Melbourne. They are interested because more and more journalists are actually fairly knowledgeable and expert in fields. They're interested, if you like, on the spins. What Ross Gittin thinks about economics is seriously worth knowing, even for Treasury people. So they're looking for this analysis, this exploration, this putting in context, this sense of history on it. And that can only be done with a certain amount of investment, but more particularly, it can only be done for a certain amount of time. It takes time to stroke your chin.
It does too, and I've run out of time, sadly, Jack. It's been great speaking with you. Fascinating, fascinating. Thank you so much, Jack.
Good.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.